We do disruption stories at the very beginning of engagements to help companies position their business in some unique, differentiated way. This actually doesn't work for every single business because not every single business is differentiated, but for those that were started for some reason, they had some unique process of doing something, they have some unique way they think about their industry, disruption stories lend themselves to that kind of thinking. And so the examples will share kind of how we extracted that unique positioning and then wrote a story talking about their differentiators. A few weeks ago, we talked about a concept called disruption stories inside of a video on content strategy for new businesses. And today we're going to talk through the writing for those disruption stories. I think Davish has a couple examples to share. I actually have no clue exactly what he's going to say because in our business, he's the one responsible for most of the writing and editing side of things. And so I think I'll just toss it over to you.
Yeah, this is my dream, is me being able to do something on this show without you having any idea what I'm going to say. So let me share my screen. This one is going to be hard to follow along if you're just listening, but it should be good enough. On YouTube, you can see the screen share.
Oh, wait. Before we get into it, one thing that I forgot to even say about disruption stories, what are they and why do we do them? So for those that haven't watched the last video, we kind of talked through this on there, but essentially, we do disruption stories at the very beginning of engagements to help companies position their business in some unique, differentiated way. So this actually doesn't work for every single business because not every single business is differentiated. But for those that were started for some reason, they had some unique process of doing something, they have some unique way they think about their industry, disruption stories lend themselves to that kind of thinking. And so in this case, these two examples, these were both businesses that had something unique about the approach that they were taking in their business. And so the examples will share kind of how we extracted that unique positioning and then wrote a story talking about their differentiators.
Yep. I mean, said quickly, you can't have a disruption story if you're not disrupting anything. So like if you have something you're disrupting, you have a disruption story. The utility of it, while I open this window, I can add on to what you just said, Benji, is that like
sure,
you can then link to it. And we actually just recorded recently. And so I don't know which order the episodes are going to come out, but you can look for our episode on this concept of can SEO content include thought leadership? And in there, we talk about the utility of it is that you can link to a disruption story in all of your other SEO content, like link back, not just for the sake of linking, not internal linking, but like you can allude to the arguments of it and say, by the way, like this is why our tool, software, approach, service exists. This is how we do things differently. This is what's broken in how people normally do it. So the disruption story that we talked about in this episode that already has been published that Benji's alluding to was something about like, what was the episode called? How we're creating a content strategy for a new company.
For a new company, yep.
And we mentioned doing this disruption story. We have since gotten permission from them to mention them. They're Miroscope.io. I don't think we mentioned them in that episode.
We didn't, no.
Brand new. As we joked about in that episode, they had a domain rating of 0.5. We have since increased it dramatically to like 4 or something.
Yeah, we're at 4.5.
All right. Moving and shaking. It's a logarithmic scale, meaning it's a lot bigger than 0.5. Literally brand new. It is technical. I will explain it. We are neither Benji or I are developers, so don't worry. If we can understand it, you can too. And as we explained there, they did create Miroscope to disrupt something that is on the cutting edge. And so this disruption story is important for that reason. It's also important for us to try to get leads and links and things like that from promoting it in non-SEO means while we wait for things to rank. As we explained in that episode, I'm going to recap. Miroscope in general is a developer toolkit you can think of, right? It says here, Miroscope is a Python toolkit. It's this library of like stuff in Python to help you code in Python, specifically code LLM apps, large language model apps. So any app you're using, like Zoom's AI companion or whatever, everything that says like add AI, whatever, even LinkedIn. Have you seen this? Or was it Twitter? Like it'll suggest replies. It's like all AI. So all those apps are connecting via some API-ish method. I'm just going to apologize outright to anyone on Miroscope who's listening to this. They're probably so uncomfortable at how I'm butchering this. But this connecting via API to something like GPT-4 or some large language model and getting them to like help generate whatever AI feature you're using inside their app. Okay? And so people are coding this. And apparently that coding is has some, you know, pains to it. And Miroscope is meant to help absolve those pains or solve those pains. One of those things is this idea that in order to, you know, get information from these large language models, like a GPT 4.0 or whatever, you need to prompt them. So just as we, regular people using ChatGPT, like type in text prompts, apparently also via API, the only way to interact with the underlying model behind it is via prompts, like literally like writing a question and then it spits back something. Like that's how that thing interacts, period. And apparently the way a lot of LLM app development so far has been done is that prompts just become like this thing that you kind of store in a text document away from your code. And as a coder, that is a big pain because the prompts themselves, you can imagine, take LinkedIn, since anyone listening is probably familiar with LinkedIn, a bunch of marketers. If LinkedIn is auto-suggesting like reply like this or whatever, I think it was LinkedIn where I saw that, but let's just pretend that's a thing. What LinkedIn is doing is taking the text in the post you're reading, pushing it into some large language model and having that thing come back and be like, suggest some replies for this person, and having that thing come back and like give you some replies. That's my gross oversimplification, not knowing what it's doing. And so because it needs to like prompt it, and those prompts, in order to like do that properly, those prompts need to have like variables and stuff in it, right? It needs to be like, the prompt needs to be like a template that's like, you know, insert code here or whatever. So what Miroscope is arguing is those prompts really end up becoming part of your code. They're like dynamic. They have variables. They change. You change things. So the normal way of coding this, where prompts live in some outside text document, hypothetically, becomes very cumbersome because if you change your code, which is a normal part of software development, stuff in the prompts could change. If you change your prompts, it could affect things downstream in the code. And they were doing this themselves and like kind of running into issues, and they were like, hey, there's got to be better developer tools to handle this. So Miroscope, the Python toolkit that it says here, it allows you to kind of manage the different versions and whatever of the prompts right in the place where you're developing. And it makes development a lot easier. That is my summary. So the disruption story, I am going to show you, this is version history. Shout out to Greg on our team that wrote this and did an amazing job. I'm going back to an early, like, look, you can scroll through all this different editing version. We're going back to one of the first versions before I edited it to just kind of talk about how we architect some of these. Let's talk about the title. So in a disruption story, and Benji, you can comment here because I'm just talking too much here. Titles need to be kind of balance both kind of clarity and honest preview into what will be discussed, but also be kind of provocative. These aren't your typical SEO titles where it's like target keyword colon, like prompting colon, like, you know, and then like the rest of your title. It doesn't need any of that. This is not for SEO. So we did some various iterations, but, you know, the title, at least at this stage, was engineers should handle. Actually, I think the later title is different, but it says engineers should handle prompting LLMs, parentheses, and prompts should live in your code base. We were trying to get that to be a little bit, what did I use? Provocative. controversial. It's not really that controversial. Of just, there are some people who think that prompts, it's actually very convenient that prompts don't live in the code base, so that product managers and non-engineers can kind of help work on the prompts. And so this hopefully like takes a strong stance. Any comments or advice on disruption story titles?
No, I think you're right. And just, it needs to be provocative. And that's usually what we go for just when we try to come up with the title.
Okay. The most important part of any disruption story is the introduction. And it needs to do this balance of not... So the first side of the balance is it needs to not be so beginner level like a lot of SEO pieces are. I've argued before in other articles you can read on the site many years ago that actually all SEO pieces should avoid being too beginner level. But especially here, you're not doing some intro guide to blah, blah, blah. You're not trying to rank for prompting 101 or some whatever SEO keyword, right? You are trying to make this seem like a, wow, I need to share this type of article to your target audience, in this case, coders. And so you got to just start off with a bang, like grab their attention. It's extremely important. No fluff, no excessive background. What's interesting here, and I'll click to my edit that came right after, is that it actually, I think Greg may have taken that too far initially and started too deep into it. So his first sentence is, prompts that include code will be part of your engineering workflow. And separating prompts from the rest of their code base, especially from their API calls. Don't worry about the little details if you don't understand it. Just follow along the bigger picture. Separating prompts from the rest of their code base, especially from the API calls, means that you're splitting that workflow into different independent parts. And then he goes into saying like, that's bad. Like it says, like it can seem to bring certain efficiencies, especially for collaboration. That's kind of a roundabout way of saying like, it's convenient to non-engineers to have prompts somewhere else. And then, you know, it continues, but eventually, and I think I edited some of this down because he does too many like, that could be good because of this, that, and the other. And he doesn't get to the main point fast enough. But eventually he says, but when you're making a complex app, like you're going to be writing code for those prompts, and it's too complicated to like separate those. Okay. So looking at my edit, I actually added a decent amount to before his intro. His intro started with prompts that include code will be part of your engineering workflow. But what I wanted to do is sort of add this credibility of making this more of an observational narrative. So listen to the tone on my proposed intro that I think made it all the way to the end here. We've seen many discussions of LLM software development allude to a workflow where prompts live outside of the code base and are managed by multiple stakeholders, including non-engineers. Already, based on everything I just gave you guys in terms of background, this already, you can see, has the heart of the conflict.
Yeah, well, it shows that you understand the problem right when someone's reading this.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I wanted to just lay out the land. Like, it's like, this is status quo, right? We've seen many discussions allude to a workflow where prompts live outside the code base and are managed by non-engineers. And then something that's going to foreshadow and set up our ability to sell Miroscope, the product. I felt like that was necessary. And I actually hadn't talked about this yet. Another key part of any disruption story is it's an excuse to sell your product. You're obviously, like we said, the whole point of disruption story is like, what are we disrupting? The product was created to disrupt something. So a good chunk of it, the back half of any disruption story is, and here is our solution to said problems. And then you go into that, you know, and you're trying to sell the product really well there. And so in Miroscope's case, a big part of their disruption story and what they're arguing is many frameworks, let's call it, for LLM development, they like further entrench this idea of prompts living outside of your code. And that's bad, you know? And so I wanted to allude to that early on and say, and that's, this sentence does that. In fact, many popular LLM development frameworks and libraries are built in a way that requires prompts to be managed outside of the code base. And then without having to sift through paragraphs, immediately, like, I say the key thing that they believe. We think this is an unnecessarily cumbersome approach that is not scalable for complex
production, I can't spell the word production, grade LLM software development. Like the key line is in there. And then we sort of move into to Greg's kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, just from my perspective, I didn't even know the edits that went into this before seeing it here. But to me, knowing their product and then knowing what was written, it just helps the second a reader who actually has this problem comes in, they know right from the first few sentences that you're talking to them, that you understand the problem they're facing, and you hook them with basically saying, if you've been developing apps and this is the process that you've been using and you've been frustrated by it, but there's no other solution that you know of, now there is, or now you should keep reading.
Yeah. Yeah. The company puts a flag in the sand and says, we believe this. And so let's look at a couple other examples before we move to other kind of subtle edits. This was a piece we wrote for a client, Rainforest QA, a while back. So I guess I need to explain who they are for any of this to make sense. But basically, it's QA software. So a lot of software, any software that's built basically, and websites, they have what's called like QA software running to constantly test it, which is like other programs, like other software that emulate humans that are like clicking on a bunch of things and making sure it's working. And if any of those ever fail because, you know, the development team pushed something live and some flow broke, that QA software that's running those like automations to basically imitate humans clicking will be like, oop, error occurred or whatever. And normally that QA software is all also code based. So the only people who can like set up these QA tests and kind of run it and manage it are coders. And that has various organizational inefficiencies. So Rainforest QA is a visual way to do it where like a person can, and they have like a new website now, so I can't really find it, but like they can sort of just click, you know, with no code and create these QA tests. So now the QA team that doesn't include coders could do it. Product teams, customer support, like anyone can do that, and it kind of democratizes QA. And so the development story we wrote for them, and I want to kind of get analogies to the Miroscope one from the intro perspective, the title was Asking Developers to Own QA is Broken, Here's a Better Way. This kind of follows what I often joke about is like my only copywriting framework. Let's just for fun go to the Grow and Convert headline, where I always do like these two sentences where the first sentence is like, the way people do it, and then like what we do differently. So our headline is, most content doesn't drive real business. We fix that on growandconvert.com. And so you can tell that some of that is in here. Asking developers to own QA is broken. Here's a better way. To contrast again with the Miroscope headline, what did it end up being? Let's go to the final version here. Oh, pretty similar. Engineers should handle prompting LLMs, and prompts should live in your code base. Yeah, maybe this is different. This headline includes the old way. The headline itself has old way and why we think the old way is not good. That's kind of interesting. That's like two different ways to do it. Okay, so similar to Miroscope's intro, where when I added stuff, we'd said like, we've seen discussions where prompts live apart from it, and that's bad. The Rainforest QA one says, many software companies have no formal QA strategy, and those that do take one of two inherently flawed approaches. That's really bold. This was a long time ago. I forgot how we wrote that. We just straight up say in the first sentences, flawed approaches. Either they ask developers to do QA or they delegate it to a siloed team. And then we say, having been in this space for a decade, they're flawed. And then we sort of explain what the flaws are. So again, there's an analogy there where we say most LLM development has prompts live outside the code base, and that's bad. So you see that, like that's like a key part of the disruption story. It's not just a writing thing. It's not just like how you write it. It's like, that's the narrative. That's like the larger narrative you need to get straight before you even attack or try to approach or do a disruption story. Is the narrative needs to be like, you need to understand that with the client, with your founder, with yourself, if you are the founder, of just like, what am I doing? And try to like, if you can fit that into a couple of sentences, most people think or do X. We do this. Our version of it is most content marketing chases top of the funnel keywords and traffic. We focus on conversions.
You could even pull up Pain Point SEO, because I think I took the same framework when writing that, if you have it up.
I almost always have Pain Point SEO just open in a tab.
Because you probably do, but you have a million tabs open.
50 tabs open at one time.
Yeah, I mean, it was the same thing when we were writing this post. If you look inside your Google Analytics, chances are the majority of your traffic comes from 2 to 5 blog posts. So like most people wouldn't think of that. I think most people would think, oh no, my blog's driving a ton of traffic, but it's to show them something. So I'm trying to get them to go look in their Google Analytics and see, okay, 2 to 5 blog posts, a majority of the traffic's coming from those, because most people naturally rank for just some keyword that drives a ton of volume for their site. And then, but then say what's different. But what's interesting is if you actually look at what's converting, it's actually different. The posts that are converting highest are typically not the ones with the highest traffic. And so it's trying to say, this is what you may think, but this is what it is, like, actuality, essentially. And so I think it's very similar. It's done a slightly different way in our post, just because of the nature of what we're talking about here, but it follows a very similar framework.
Yeah. And then so the rest of it to kind of pay attention to is just, and I had this in the edit here, is try to make the rest of it do this dance. So first of all, in the intro, when you get that narrative straight, there is writing. Like, these are tricky to write, is you need to get the writing right, where you kind of do that. You try not to get too much background, but you don't go too deep into it. So you got to balance that on your own, and it can be tricky. Then the rest of it needs to kind of do this balance between kind of narrative and telling your story. We used to call these founding stories for a reason, right? Because, like, you know, the founding team and the founders would have something they're disrupting, and that's kind of important. And so, for example, here's an edit that kind of indicates trying to do that balance, where what Greg initially had was why you need developer tools for prompt engineering. And I remember my comment I attached to this, I changed it to our frustrations with developer tools for prompt engineering, because, and this is a subtle nuance thing, but it was like, why you need developer tools for prompt engineering. It felt too almost salesy, like an SEO piece, like you need this. And I wanted to kind of keep that kind of we're telling a story vibe and say, like, our frustrations with. And my argument is, if you're telling the story of, like, our frustrations with developer tools for prompt engineering, like, and you do that well, the reader's gonna buy into it. You are selling your thing, but you're doing it in this kind of story way. And that's this other difference between an SEO piece. If you're just writing a tool for, like, you know, prompt engineering tools as a keyword, they're Googling prompt engineering tools, just go ahead and sell it. List a bunch of tools and sell yours. They're Googling for it. But disruption story is showing up in someone's social feed, so you need to kind of be a little bit more, like, careful or finesse that. And then there's various edits here around, like, kind of that. Like, it was around that time that we began asking ourselves, like, I'm just kind of adding a little bit of that story aspect to it. And then the last thing is, I wanted to just scroll through the parts where, like, they just get into the features. And that's smooth sailing. And in this case, it's beyond all of our heads, including mine. There's, like, literally code snippets, so don't worry about that. But it's like, you know, here's our feature, and then, like, built-in data validation for error-free prompting. Like, at some point, you're going to get into the features and benefits, right? Like, here are the benefits of it. But yeah, I think a bunch of people asked us when we did that previous video, let's talk through a disruption story. And this is kind of what it is.
Yeah, and we can share the links to both of them in the comments.
Yep. Any questions, just let us know. If you like this video, don't forget to subscribe. You can also get the audio-only versions of these shows wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us at growandconvert.com/newsletter for any articles and updates for when these videos come out.